No doubt you've heard or said the phrase, "I'll believe it when I see it." I was doing something I never thought I would ever do several months ago. I was doing some pre-engagement counseling, not premarital counseling, mind you, but pre-engagement counseling. I guess the couple that was dating, they thought they were dealing with issues that were rather substantial, and so they wanted to meet with me to work things out. I'm not sure I helped, but there it is. Anyway, the issue that came up, and they're not here, so don't worry about it. The issue that came up was, where is my ring? The young woman involved had expected the ring by spring, which I guess never sprung. So no ring for her. She was upset, and he was assuring her in our meeting, look, I'm saving up money. I'm just waiting for the right moment. I have a plan. And evidently, he had a lot of plans for a lot of things that never came to fruition. And so she said, I'll believe it when I see it. And I think she's still waiting to see. But you know what that's like. People talk a big game. They promise lots of things. Politicians always promise us the eschaton and yet don't deliver. Wah, wah. You've been promised by your hardworking spouse that they'll eventually take time off and spend time with the family or organize a vacation for the whole family, and you'll believe it when you see it. Or you're dealing with somebody in your own family who is drinking just way too much, and it's just an absolute disaster. And you say to stop, and they say, yeah, I'll try, I know I have to cut back, and you think, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. And I think a healthy degree of skepticism is good for you. I mean, it's really good not to fall for every internet scam, right? I mean, you have to have a sort of some common sense to survive in life. But you know, Thomas is not the patron saint of common sense. You know that? Because he doesn't just say, I'll believe it when I see it. Seeing doesn't do anything for him. He says, I don't care if I see it or not. I'll only believe it if I touch. Not just touch. The Greek is thrust my finger. I want to thrust my finger into wounded skin, or I am saying sayonara to the whole faith project. So Thomas is not just skeptical. He disbelieves. And I want to speak tonight about proof and about faith. And hopefully this will land for us. But here's the proof bit. It starts at the beginning of our passage where the other disciples tell Thomas, we have seen, opthe, with the eyes, optometrist, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and then place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. Indefinite. Never believe. Now, seeing and sight in this passage seems to suggest evidence, but Thomas wants more than visible evidence. He wants something tangible, visceral. And why does he want this? Because he's a type A, left-brained, committed pragmatist. Now, by the way, being right-brained and artsy is great. I love you English majors. I like reading your poetry. But we also need people to build bridges, right? Like, we need people that are type A and understand how Excel spreadsheets work, right? That's very helpful. And we know Thomas is a pragmatist because of the two other comments that are made by him in John's gospel. We don't know a lot about Thomas, but we know a little. Here's the little that we know. When Jesus was approaching Jerusalem, all of his followers and disciples were absolutely entranced by the possibility of power. Now we are marching into town to finally claim what's ours. Thomas looked at the situation and saw through the hype and said, much to the chagrin of the others, let us go and die with him. He saw that the future, the imminent future, was very grim, and he was prepared to walk the dark road with Jesus because he was a pragmatist. He knew what was going to happen. Also, we have a scene of Thomas the pragmatist at the Last Supper. Jesus in John's gospel is waxing rather eloquently and is speaking about himself being a great path to the ultimate Father, and he says, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. And he's speaking very philosophically and existentially and very deeply, but Thomas is just not having it. And so he says, Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way? Meaning, can you not give us a riddle right now? Like, it's not the time. Right? Because he's just a pragmatist. He wants to cut through all the poetry. Well, Thomas, the one who said, let's go and die with him, and Thomas, the one who said, how can we know the way? Please, like, be direct with us. Then sees his Messiah, his rabbi, his healer, his professor, his holy one, be obliterated and shamed in front of the clapping nation. And it broke him. By the way, many people within a faith tradition are utterly devastated within that tradition and lose their faith or seem to lose their faith because of tragedy, because of things that happen in life that do not make sense in light of God's evident goodness, and they can't put all the pieces together. And so they throw away the puzzle. And that's what he did. I mean, you can't see a crucifixion and walk away the same kind of person. Can't do that. And so he hears about what happens to Jesus because he's hiding away like all the other disciples except John, and he's destroyed, and he can't recover. He just can't recover. And so when Jesus dies, Thomas's faith dies. Now, I want to say, in a sense, Thomas's doubt doesn't make him completely unique. A doubting disciple is not a rare phenomenon in the Bible. This is one of the many reasons why I love Scripture, is because it's so bizarrely honest. One of my favorite passages is in Luke 24. Jesus rises from the dead. Women see his appearing. They go and testify to the disciples that Jesus has risen from the dead just like he said he would. And this is what Luke 24 says. The women's words seemed to the disciples an idle tale, and they did not believe them. The same thing is offered in Matthew 28, where the risen Jesus is literally standing 8.5 feet away from these dudes. He's about to ascend. He gives them their marching orders. This is the moment where he's about to be usurped into the heavens. And this is what the text says. The 11 disciples went to Galilee to the mountain appointed by Jesus. When they saw Jesus, they worshiped him, but some doubted. He's 8.5 feet away. He's right there. Now, why were they doubting? Were they just stupid? No, of course not. Their whole paradigm was destroyed. They had a messianic paradigm of unbridled shock, awe, and success. Jesus was supposed to fulfill that. He was supposed to be a kingly General Patton who would march into town, not only overthrow the Jewish despots, but overthrow Caesar and completely transform the world without being obliterated on a Roman cross and having to resurrect. Now they inherit a world in which the Messiah's key moment was death and destruction. And then he physically was brought back 3 days later. That threw their paradigm into great chaos. And so they're recovering from that moment. And so all of the disciples doubt at some point or another. What's interesting about Thomas, though, is his doubt is deeper. His doubt is deeper. He didn't just struggle. He didn't just have questions or suspicions. In a real sense, he stopped believing. He stopped believing. Because when your world is decimated and the person you love the most bleeds to death and really is shamed before the watching eyes of the world, you don't recover very easily. And Thomas could not believe the testimony of the people that claim to see something like a resurrection. For him, seeing was not enough. That's why he says, unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and then place my finger into that scar tissue and into his side, thrust my hand there, I will never believe. Like, the deal is broken. I will not do it. In other words, what Thomas wants is proof that exceeds the proof that the other disciples saw. They saw the risen Jesus. Thomas wants to touch the risen Jesus. Touch the scars. Why touch the scars? To make sure that what the other disciples is seeing is the real Jesus that was really crucified on a real Roman cross. I need to make sure that's really him. That this is not a hallucination or some sort of imposter. I need to make sure this is real, or I will never believe. I think Thomas's demand for that kind of visceral proof teaches us something very powerful about the nature of skepticism, especially skepticism that's very, very deep, and it's this. Skepticism is almost always impossible to satisfy. When skepticism is your Lord and God sitting upon the crimson throne of life, it is almost impossible to satisfy. I have a friend who is an anti-theist and sort of cynically charming in his own way, but I asked him once, you know, what would it take for you to bend the knee? What would it take for you to acknowledge that there's more going on than just us chickens? You know, there's more. There's like a center to this thing, and that center is loving and compassionate and gave his son and all that. And I said, would it help you if you had very close friends who experienced it very deeply, experienced the spirit of Jesus living in them and recultivating them and transforming who they are on the inside? Would that help you to know it's real? And he's like, of course not. He said, people have all sorts of inner experiences that they regard as spiritual that are fraudulent. And it may help them subjectively, but it's not real. I thought, okay. What if then God solved your intellectual queries? Like, you have all these objections to the Christian faith in your brain. What if all of a sudden you had enlightenment and you understood the mysteries and you could make sense of everything? Would that do it for you? And he said, well, of course not, because your mind can play tricks on you all the time. You know, brains play games on us. And so how do I know that these new answers are completely correct? I'm like, okay. What about, like, existentially? What about your emotional life? Because he was an anxious mess. And I said, what if you stopped being anxious? What if God soothed you so that you would find yourself having complete emotive equilibrium all the time, and you could feel better about yourself and the world, and you would then feel like God was close? He said, no, no, no. There's nothing more deceitful than your emotions. I'm like, okay. What if, like, Jesus Christ gave you a miracle? What if, because he has all sorts of health problems. I'm like, what if they were all fixed? Like, you had a dream, and in the dream, Jesus, like, touched your forehead, and then all of a sudden you were cured, and you didn't have to take your pills anymore. Would you believe then? He said, well, of course not, because people can have psychosomatic healing. You know, it's just weird things happen to people's bodies, and they recover suddenly, and who knows why? And I'm like, okay. I'm like, what if Jesus literally appeared to you in the room and, like, grabbed you by the shoulders and said, hi, I'm real, and you should believe in me. It will help you a great deal. And he said, well, because people have visionary experiences. What about Joseph Smith? I mean, come on. Like, people have all these things that they say that they have received, and they were just hallucinating. Maybe they ate a bad meal or had, you know, psilocybin or something. I'm like, okay. So I said to him very simply, basically you're telling me that every one of God's, like, the faculties that God gave you, right, your emotions, the way you think, the way you see, the way you relate to other people, all of those avenues are cut off. So literally every avenue that could be used to convince you would not work. So literally nothing would convince you. And to his credit, he said, that is correct. Nothing would convince me because I don't want it to be true. And I said, well, at least you're honest. And I appreciated the honesty. Pray for that bloke. Anyway, so this is sort of where Thomas is. Never. Remember, Thomas says never. I will never believe. I'm done. And some of you in this room have felt that way at times in this whole faith pilgrimage of saying, like, no way. Count me out. I'm done. Well, that's where Thomas was in his need for visceral proof. Outside of that, he's done. But then something happens that creates or re-engages faith within him. This is verse 26. 8 days later, so Thomas had to live in this acidic, skeptical brine for a week. 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe. Thomas answered him, my Lord and my God. I want you to notice two beautiful things. First, Jesus doesn't leave Thomas in his doubt, nor does he approach Thomas with hostility. He offers to meet Thomas's demands. Second, notice that the text does not actually say that Thomas did what he so sternly and stentoriously demanded. I want to touch the wounds. It doesn't say that he did that. He saw, and it seems like seeing was enough. And not only was seeing enough, something at that point, something wild spills from the lips of this former skeptic. He says this daring phrase, "My Lord and my God." That is the most radical statement of faith in the gospel accounts. Now, Jesus was called many complimentary things in his life. Son of God, Son of David, Son of Man, Rabbi, Christ, King of the Jews. But no crowd, no disciple, not even Jesus Christ himself used these words, "My Lord and my God." You know, I think it's an astounding thing that Thomas leaps from, "This was all ridiculous and it was not true," to, "This man is not just a man, but is Yahweh. This is the same one who spoke to us from the burning bush. This is the one who led us through the Red Sea. This is the one who raised people from the dead in the life of Elijah." I mean, this is the same one. This is the immortal one who has been materialized among us. It's the same entity. It's Yahweh in the flesh. "My Lord and my God." He switches that quickly. Now, this is why I think doubting Thomas should be redubbed. I think he should be Thomas the Courageous or Thomas the Confessor, because he said something so bold and it was not rejected. He makes the bravest Christological claim in the whole New Testament. So good for Thomas, yeah? I mean, he saw something. He knew something in the moment. And this is apocryphal, but there are a lot of attestations to it, that Thomas's faith in the very real, very risen Jesus drove him to go farther missionally than any other disciple. You know, Peter does go to Rome, it seems, but Thomas goes all the way to India. He goes to India. There's a church there right now that claims to have his bones. I don't know. But there's a lot of records to say that he went the distance. You know, he went the 1,000 miles because he had something to say about a real risen Jesus who was here to raise the world from death, and he wanted the people there to know. And so that's something about proof that he wanted, but the faith that was then created in him when the kindly Jesus comes to him in his moment of despondency and offers him something. I want to close with a word to us from this passage, you know, because we've never seen the risen Jesus, and we've never certainly touched the risen Jesus. We are people who live by faith in Jesus, and faith is really important in the New Testament. After all, St. Paul says that we are justified by faith, by trusting in the legitimate Christ who died and rose again to make us legitimate. And also, Jesus says in this passage, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe," and that's you. So how can we be helped by this passage? I think there are two lessons that it gives us, and here they are, two helps. We'll call them expression and companionship. Here's what I like about Thomas, his expressiveness. Thomas doesn't hide away his doubts in the dark corridors of his heart. He instead expresses them directly and bluntly. And what I want to say to you about the grace of God is that the grace of God welcomes the untidy aspects of your inner core to come forth rather than be shielded. You always know that grace is working when you don't have to hide the aspects of yourself that you wish did not exist. Instead, Thomas felt comfortable to say, "This is what I believe or don't believe." And so grace welcomes and pulls out the doubt voice to say what it has to say. And so whether you're skeptical today about the inspiration of the Bible, or you're skeptical about the resurrection, or you're skeptical about Jesus' divinity, or you're skeptical about whether God really does love you in a consistent way because you think you're disgusting, yeah? Or whether you are skeptical about your own conversion experience, were you just like riding a wave of emotion or what? Well, whatever it is, we can express those questions and those doubts, because as we do, I think we'll discover two things. One, Jesus Christ does not run from skeptics. Two, Jesus Christ holds up very well to scrutiny. Remember, Jesus Christ is reality. Jesus is reality. And there is nothing deeper than Jesus. He is the ground of being. And so no matter how deep you dig, you're still going to run into Christ. And so you can investigate, and I encourage you to do so. When St. Paul writes to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, that working out tends to mean something like working through, wrestling with it, like Isaac does in the Old Testament, right? He wrestles with God, yeah? Jacob, right? Did I get that wrong? Thank you. Okay, I knew. Thank you for sharing. Now I understand. I think that as we do this, we'll discover time and time again that Jesus Christ, as the ground of being, as the bedrock of reality, does actually make sense of reality better than anyone else. So express it. The second thing is companionship. Thomas, though entirely skeptical, did not bail on the band. Did you notice that? He's still with them in this passage, right? He doesn't Yoko himself out of the band. Now, some of you understood that reference, thank God. Here's what I want to say to you. Please don't deal with doubt in some mental cave, all isolated, because doubts always become exaggerated when they bounce around the echo chamber of your isolated brain. They always, always, always get worse. So if you've got questions or skepticism or doubts, just talk to normal fellow traveler Christians who are kind and learned and have wrestled themselves. It will help you spiritually. I have a friend who was kind enough to do that with me. He was a priest and was. And we're friends. But after experiencing very serious mental illness and a marriage that ended and a very ill child, chronically ill, his faith just dissolved, you know? It dissolved. But he came to me and he wanted to talk about it. I liked that very much. And I asked him if anything about Jesus still appealed to him or was charming to him in any way. And in response to that question, he sent me a letter. He had to think about it. And in the letter, he sent me a poem written by William Cooper. William Cooper was a hymnist and a poet and a student of John Newton. Remember the author of Amazing Grace, former slave trader and all that? Yeah. Well, Cooper himself suffered very seriously from, you know, what we understand to be a bipolar condition. And he also struggled with doubt and despair. And in a place of grave despair and doubt, Cooper wrote a poem for a friend of his who was dying, and this dying friend he imagined would soon be in heaven, while he, William Cooper, with his life of complexity and doubt, would surely be in hell, at least according to his own estimation. Cooper wrote these lines to his dying friend. Such Jesus is, and such his grace. Oh, may he shine on you. Please tell him when you see his face that I long to see him too. To my despondent friend who clung to this honest poem, I wrote a little postcard, and on it I simply put the words, may it be credited to you as righteousness. Because he still wanted it to be true. He still wanted it to be true. Friends, Jesus Christ died not only for your evident sins, but also for your hidden doubts, for your lackluster faith, and for your reservoirs of despair. By the cross, we're forgiven for it all. You know, faith is important, but it is only temporary, because one day, according to the New Testament, faith shall be sight, and faith shall be touch, and you will discover more than you can possibly fathom about the everlasting arms. You just need to wait a little longer, and you will see, and you will feel. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.